Hello, I'm Arnold Hamilton, editor of the Oklahoma Observer.
And I'm Marianne Martin, and this is ObserverCast, your weekly deep dive into Oklahoma politics and policy, powered by the Oklahoma Observer Democracy Foundation.
A titanic struggle for the future of Oklahoma public education has begun. Will it end with Oklahomans unifying to protect and invest in a system that welcomes all comers, regardless of race, religion, socioeconomic status, ability, or disability? Or will school privatizers who want to steer tax dollars into for-profit and religious schools finally achieve their fondest dreams, to dismantle so-called government schools? New State Superintendent Ryan Walters made clear whose side he's on. The deep-pocketed Waltons, DeVosses, and Kochs, who never met a public teat they didn't want to latch on to, greater good be damned. Walter's shameful performance before a House Budget Committee subcommittee won sharp criticism from both sides of the political aisle, not only because he was ill-prepared, but also because he seems to think real leadership is all about performance politics. His public proclamations reduced to a noun, a verb, and an epithet, usually woke or indoctrination. He and his mentor, Governor Kevin Stitt, are pushing vouchers that would decimate public education, particularly in rural Oklahoma. He persuaded a Stitt-appointed State Board of Education to propose a budget that eliminates across-the-board pay raises for Oklahoma's woefully underpaid and often disrespected school teachers. And to top it all off, Walters, who double dips at the taxpayer's trough by getting paid $40,000 a year to be Stitt's cabinet secretary for education, dispatched a typo-riddled letter to the state's higher education chancellor demanding to know all about spending and materials involved with diversity, equity, and inclusion. For this week's ObserverCast, we invited veteran educator turned Tulsa State Representative John Waldron, who sat in on the House budget hearing, to help us unpack the all-out assault on public education. So, John, apocalypse now?
Apocalypse how? I think Ryan Walters has a lot of ideas. I'm not sure he knows how to implement them yet. But I do know that he's already caused a great deal of disruption in just a few days in office. So that's pretty impressive.
I feel like the past couple years, particularly the first episode of the Stitt administration was like, say we were in London and we could hear the war going on over on the continent. Mm. And now it feels like the bombers are heading straight to London. You know, like, I really, really feel like we're about to have to hit battle stations in ways that we thought we had already gone to, you know, like, it's coming.
Well, we football-loving Oklahomans need to remember where the term blitz came from. And I think you're right. The presentation of the budget on Tuesday was very disappointing. Just before he began his presentation, he walked over to several of us Democrats and offered his hand. And one member who had been utterly offended by his talk about trans students just couldn't do it. I shook his hand, but I said that we Democrats were going to keep asking this question: are you ready to stop campaigning and start governing? He didn't really answer us until he went and began his presentation, and it was pretty clear that the man is still in campaign mode. We were given a four-page document with a few graphics on it, and that was all we got by way of performance review, and he announced early on that he was not going to present us with a budget. We've learned since then that Chairman McBride contacted his office, reached out to him several times, and when there were no responses to emails or texts, they sent a letter down to his office establishing their expectations. They said, and this was all before the meeting began, that they expected to see a budget presentation or at least a description of how any new budget might vary from the one that had been approved previously. And a review of and a performance review of the state agency. Ryan Walters didn't respond, but a staffer did receive that letter. And so we had every expectation on Tuesday that we would get those things. We just didn't. The superintendent did not or could not or would not give us any sense of what his budget highlights were going to be. And his performance review quickly descended into more politicking, I'm afraid. So I think members on both sides of the aisle were deeply frustrated with things. And at one point, the chairman McBride even questioned what we were doing there in that chamber if we weren't going to have what we'd asked for.
So can we paint the picture for what this typically goes like in these budget request hearings? I mean, my experience has been it's not a four-page handout.
No, typically this
to begin with.
Right. I've been, this will be my, I'm starting my fifth year in the legislature. So I've seen Superintendent Hoffmeister present detailed booklets full of graphs. She would walk through them for at least an hour, showing us what the State Department of Education had been doing and how it had tried to accomplish its metrics. And then she would put out her request for a budget for the next year. For example, she typically implored us to approve money for school counselors because she was she believed emphatically that we needed more counselors in school to deal with all the needs of our students. And after that, we would have a vigorous discussion about priorities in the State Department of Education. I didn't always agree with Superintendent Hoffmeister, but we always found her to be courteous, well-informed, and well-prepared. I think we'll have to get used to something new now.
Well, I mean, it's not necessarily that I think agencies should be deferential to the legislature, but they should be respectful, you know, and I would say that what Walters presented, Superintendent Walters presented the legislature with last week was deeply disrespectful, not only of his office, but of the legislature's time. And that matters, you know, that really matters on so many levels. And I have to ask if, you know, when they really start working on the budget, which we have all said, we don't know, the public doesn't see, the Democrats don't see till it's out. But I don't think it's going to be as easy for him as he expects based on this, you know, introductory disrespect that he gave to Chairman McBride.
Yeah, I'd like to go back to that handshake moment. We each had to make a choice, and my choice was you have to respect the office. And so I respectfully, I shook his hand and I told him what we would do up front, because it's our job as the minority party to be the party that calls into question the government. But we can't do that if he won't share information with us. And Republicans and Democrats alike were frustrated that we were called from all over the state to attend this meeting. He had every opportunity to tell us he wasn't going to be prepared, and he just chose not to. So he wasted the time of legislators who on our committee, we must represent, you know, 500,000 Oklahomans, maybe more. And the voters deserve better. They deserve more accountability and transparency from their elected officials.
I mean, as far as we can tell, though, what did he present in terms of substance? Was there any last week?
Well, what I gleaned from it was that he was dissatisfied with the operation of our schools, that our teachers had not been trained in the science of reading. He used that term several times, but I think he defined it pretty narrowly down to phonics. I'm no expert on the science of reading, but I do know that there are a lot of aspects to how we teach kids to read. I also know that that's not the only thing that a public school system does. And he seemed to have a sort of a monochromatic view of education. He referenced in the presentation merit-based pay for teachers. I note that Superintendent Hoffmeister had called for a $5,000 raise for teachers across the board, but he said we were going to institute a merit-based system. I think he talked about scrapping the TLE, which is the mechanism by which teachers are evaluated. So I'm not sure how those two ideas go together. I could be wrong, but if we're going to pay teachers on the basis of merit, why are we throwing away the system that rates the teachers? In the State Board of Education meeting, he went into a little bit more detail about those things, but I'm reminded of something that comes up in the movie The Princess Bride. You keep using that word, but I don't think that word means what you think it means. I'm not sure Or let's go. I'm not sure he understands the implications of everything that he intends to change in the system yet. He's talking about he talked about thinking outside the box and a big, bold approach to education. But if I had only 8 years of teaching in the public school system, I would want to do a bit more study first. The conservative philosopher Edmund Burke said that we have these traditions and customs in place for a reason. We might not always know why we do a thing the way we do until we stop doing it. When we take away our custom or tradition, it often causes a disaster that reminds us of why we had that. I think if we take away the teacher raise and say we're only going to pay on the basis of merit without a clear definition of what merit is, we're going to reward a few teachers, insulting a lot of other teachers. And we're going to tend to reward teachers in more affluent areas if we're looking at things like test scores. And that's not where our teaching crisis is most acute. We're going to accelerate the flight of teachers from districts that are where students are at risk or challenged, because it'll be harder for them to demonstrate their merit. Though the teachers in those districts are some of the most important teachers we have in the state. They have some of the hardest jobs. So if we're loosey-goosey about who we're going to pay more and who we aren't, and it's not clear and transparent to teachers, I think a lot of them are going to have one more reason to pick up their sticks and go home. The superintendent has identified his top three priorities. I note that none of them is the teacher shortage, even though we had, 4,000 emergency certified teacher applications this year, which is a new state record. We have a new category of full-time adjunct teachers, almost 400 of them. The teaching shortage is becoming a crisis. Well, I'll just say it is a crisis. And the fact that he hasn't made that a priority and that he has what I think is a kind of a cavalier solution to the problem alarms me.
But if you come into a meeting like this and you're long on rhetoric and short mm-hmm. on specifics, then you can in many ways sort of avoid the tough questions that you don't have to worry about getting from a STIT-appointed state board of education, right?
Yeah. No, yeah, that's absolutely right. But the legislature is a different matter. I'm looking forward to the presentation next week. It was scheduled for Tuesday. It's been moved to Wednesday now. I think the superintendent has given himself another extension. But for example, he was taking questions. A Republican member who worked with him for many years asked him a point blank question about how superintendents are afraid they're going to get a 10% cut in their funding. How can we reassure them? And his answer to that was to pivot to indoctrination. I don't know how you get to indoctrination from a simple funding question about school districts. And I think I see a pattern here that when the superintendent is pushed, he indulges in rhetoric. Now, we have to govern here. We have an enormous school system, 703,000 students. It's the largest appropriated budget item. It takes a lot to get the details right. And we can't be cavalier about this. This isn't the Gear Fund where we could spend $8 million on plasma TVs and Christmas trees and somehow get away with it. If we get this budget wrong, if we see misappropriation of funds the way we have with Epic Gear or Swadley's, we can't Swadley this budget. And so a lot of kids are going to be hurt and a lot of employees are going to be hurt if we don't get the details right. The people of Oklahoma deserve a superintendent who does his homework and gets the details right.
I mean, so let's talk about what that means. You know, in the past, 10 years, mm-hmm. We've seen when there's been budget shortfalls, you know, that means that's a question of payroll in some districts. You know, that, yeah. I mean, there are real world implications, like material effects of, to be quite a little philosophical, but there are material effects. Yeah. Whenever things are not budgeted properly for right. the state schools. I mean, it means people don't get paid. It means people lose their jobs, which means fewer teachers in the classroom, which actually doesn't seem to matter at all to Stitt or Walters, obviously, from what you're saying, if they're not going to address this, you know, the teacher shortfall. But that means cutting programs. That means cutting classes. That means, you know, some really hard choices to keep the lights on. in yeah. some of these districts around the state, like and that's largely because if I'm not wrong, schools are not allowed to carry over funds necessarily, so they don't have these slush funds that they're sitting on that they can draw upon to, you know, boost up their reservoirs for the coming school year. I mean, if the money's not there, the money's not there.
Yeah, the carryover rules are a little complicated. Schools do carry over from one semester to the next, but that has to do with the nature of school funding. We don't carry over from one year to the next, no matter what our detractors may say. We're talking about a lot of money here. And to review, we were the problem with EPIC Youth Services was a failure of the politicians to hold a private management firm accountable. The problem of the Gear Fund scandal was a failure of the government to keep track of how parents were spending money that was distributed through the superintendent's program, a digital wallet. We have a right as taxpayers to ask how our money's spent and where it's going. And if we're not careful with that, well, let me back up and give you an example. When the CARES Act money was distributed, some of it went to the governor, some of it went to the superintendent, Joy Hoffmeister. Same process with ARPA. Every dollar that went to the State Department of Education through CARES Act and ARPA was spent on time or on schedule to be spent on time and has been and followed OCAS standards. That's our cost accounting system. We can track where that money went. It was appropriately spent or it's about to be spent. The federal dollars that went to the governor and the state superintendent were mired in scandal or were not spent at all. Beyond the issue of education, the legislature had to come together to spend money that the governor had been sitting on for a long time with ARPA. If we transfer the accounting standards and spending habits of the governor and then Secretary of Education Ryan Walters to the education budget, we are at risk for not spending money, not meeting federal requirements, facing clawbacks, misappropriations of money. That's a lot of state dollars, a lot of federal dollars. We have a right to know what's going to happen to them, and our record is not so good.
And let's be clear, on those federal clawbacks, they claw that money back whether you have it or not.
Right. It would come out of our appropriations.
Yeah, you have to pay the federal money. The federal government gets their dollars back from somewhere in the big bucket of money. So it doesn't matter if SDE has it or not. The federal government will get it.
That's right. I do believe we owe the federal government $615,000, which will come out of our general appropriations for the gear funds. But for those who haven't been paying it, who haven't studied it closely, the Secretary Walters was given $8 million. He distributed it through a program called Digital Wallet to give to parents for educational purposes.
And this is a vendor out of Florida, correct?
That is correct. Secretary Walters gave blanket approval for all expenses. Subsequent audits by the federal government found that monies were being spent on Christmas trees and plasma televisions. And that's why we have to pay back at least $615,000 of it. Probably, I would say that the fraud, graft and inappropriate spending. Maybe we should just say inappropriate spending until we prove the rest of it is a lot more than $600,000.
And I think we do need to add here that in response to that, and in order to head off problems before the general election last year for Stitt's re-election and also for Walter's election, the state filed suit against, what's it called again?
Digital Wallet.
Digital Wallet.
But the lawsuit, interestingly, was never served.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't go anywhere, you know, but it gave a great talking point.
So smoke and mirrors, smoke and mirrors, a lot of sleight of hand. I mean, I mean, there's a lot of, it's not even lip service, right? I think it's like, oh, well, you know, I've been caught, ho ho, slap me on the hand.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I wonder, because that kind of happened with Swadley's, the Swadley fiasco. And then now the new attorney general is like, you know what? We're going to follow through on that. and EPIC too. Guess what? We're going to follow through on that one as well. So it will be interesting to see Because, you know, I mean, it's one thing if our state legislators and our state treasurer and our state whoever doesn't come through and be like, you know what, we're going to get that money back from you. But the federal government will. I mean, end of story, the federal government comes for its dollars, you know? And so with all this ARPA funding, with all this federal money that came into the state, if it was misused, misappropriated, mishandled, they're going to come for it.
Yes, yes.
And it will just be that $615,000. Right. So, I mean, Sit likes to act like that won't happen. But I mean, and the funny part is they run on the fact that it does happen, right? Like, this is their main talking point, that look at how poorly government is run. And yet, I mean, they're a case in point of misuse of federal dollars. It doesn't erode federal public trust, but that's a whole other issue.
It reminds me of the lawyer defending a client accused of murdering his parents who appeals to the jury by saying, pity this poor orphan.
Yes, that's exactly right. Yeah.
Maybe this is why, too, they're hell-bent on eliminating federal funding for Oklahoma public schools. Then we don't have to worry about the big, bad federal government coming in and telling us what we can and can't do with our schools.
Dewey, if we did that, and you notice that is we have not, the superintendent did mention that in some of his campaign speeches, and now we do have a bill by Senator Bullard that would do that. So since you bring that up, it's worth pointing out that all of our special education dollars are federal, that Title I money is crucial for the operations of our schools, school lunch programs, so many things, especially things that affect the poorest and most marginalized students, are covered by federal dollars. And I do not see a practical way for our state to give up those monies or to find a way to pay for that ourselves. So if we were to give up federal dollars, our schools would get poorer and the kids who need it the most would be hurt the most.
And of course, Senator Bullard is an ex-teacher, right?
Yeah, that's true.
So I guess there's good news and bad news here. The good news is he's no longer in the classroom dealing with impressionable students. The bad news is he's at the legislature where he can wield some power.
There are a lot of good educators. There are a lot of educators and there are a lot of good educators. Maybe that's a Venn diagram. Is serving in the legislature. But I will say that there are two kinds of us. Some of us came in because we thought we needed to protect the public school system. We're the protectors. Others came in having observed how the system is imperfect and wanting to fix it. Those are the correctors. And so there's an interesting battle between correctors and protectors. I would say you don't correct the system when it's on life support. Teacher. Right.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to sustain something that's barely breathing. You know, you want it to be healthy. Right. Yeah.
First thing you do, let's stop the bleeding. Let's make sure the school system is healthy and that it's recovered from, 10 years of massive cuts prior to the 2018 raise, then the pandemic and lockdown. Let's address all the damage and get the schools on a good footing. Then we can talk about things like merit pay. Merit pay is not a good issue for us to talk about when we're struggling to get anyone in the classroom. When our teaching is a job that's so attractive that we have competition for the positions again, that's when we introduce merit pay.
You know, I would say I something just clicked when we were logging on to this, was that they're bringing this to higher ed as well. Yeah. Higher ed is, and it's not necessarily for faculty, but it is for staff. And higher ed is not much different than, K-12 in terms of employees kind of suffering under stagnation of pay, terribly underpaid for what they bring to the profession, the various professions. And yet our regents are coming to the table saying, well, there's not going to be any more across the board raises. It will only be merit pay. I just realized, I mean, these are recent appointments, if you get what I'm saying. And, it's very much a talking point that things should be based on merit and not across the board. Never mind the fact that you have a depressed, a depressed, demoralized workforce. And that could apply to almost every public sector employee in the state of Oklahoma.
Yeah. You would be shocked to find out what an adjunct teacher earns at a community college or even some of our best private universities.
Oh, for sure. I mean, oh my goodness. Like, and it's not much different than, you know, a K-12 teacher, honestly. And so, and just the people who, you know, answer the phones and, you know, push the paper at the college, at the universities, same thing, right? Like, I mean, so it's just, I mean, across the board, you know, higher ed, education writ large is under, really under attack, I mean, in ways that we have not seen. And I just wanted to ask, I've been seeing recently, and this doesn't seem accurate to me, but you two would know better than I do, that when Mary Fallon left office, or when Brad Henry was in office, that we ranked much higher education wise. And I was like, is that the case? Like, have we really dropped, like, from 11th or 17th down to 46th?
You know, the metrics are always a bit challenging, but Oklahoma has traditionally punched above its weight on education. We haven't paid our teachers very much or invested enough in our school system, I would argue, for most of our history. But we got better outcomes than you might have expected, because Oklahoma has a lot of great families that produce a lot of great teachers. Mm-hmm. And we've been able to instill a spirit of discipline, rigor, and community in our public schools and in higher ed. During Mary Fallon's years, we entered a decade in which we led the nation in cuts to education. It was something like 35%, beginning mostly around the mortgage meltdown, the Great Recession. It didn't help that that the Janet Barisi years were also very disruptive and destructive to public education. And so by the time of the teacher, and well, we could say teacher walkout, but I'll point out that there were a lot of parents and students and other community supporters walking out with them. But in 2018, when 50,000 people assembled around the Capitol, it was after many years of crisis in our schools. We did a little good stuff there. We gave teachers a raise, but we didn't reduce classroom sizes. And we didn't stop the inflammatory anti-public education rhetoric we've been hearing from many of our state elected officials throughout this period. So that teachers are demoralized, parents are frustrated. And we have a lot of people who are hearing things like CRT and indoctrination, and that our schools are making kids gay. And all of that is very destructive, right down to the school board level, where we're starting to see disruptions of school board meetings, the disruption of ordinary services, and the election of people who indulge in conspiracy theories. So we're at a difficult moment. Our public school system is under a lot of pressure and under attack. And that has affected our outcomes, unfortunately, for a lot of Oklahomans. However, I would like to point out that there are more students enrolled in our public schools now than ever before in our history. 703,000 kids. Parents are choosing to send their kids to the public school. They could go to homeschool. They could go to, many of them could seek private schools. But 703,000 kids are relying on our public schools today. That's a measure of the strength and resilience of the public school system. Despite all the attacks, despite a pandemic and the budget cuts, our schools continue to deliver services to record numbers of Oklahomans.
Do you think they're going to try and get away around the constitutional provision that's like right up top in the Oklahoma Constitution mandating free public schools?
I think they will try, yeah. You just asked a history question, a history teacher, so I will point out that there's a good reason we have public education is mandated in our Constitution, and it has to do with child labor. We put that provision in to get kids out of the mines and the factories and to give them a better future. It's interesting because we have lots of politicians today who talk about how the purpose of our public schools is workforce preparation. Actually, we did it to get the kids out of the workforce so that they could go and invent a better economy that they could be the workforce in. So we have a constitutional obligation. And it's not just about providing kids with a public school. It's about providing a better future for our state. And I'm going to hold our elected officials accountable on that point.
You know, I mean, I've spent a lot of time lately looking at census rolls, trying to trace my ancestors. Uh-huh. And it's really shocking to go back a century, to go back 70 years. And, you know, go back to the 1800s family that I can find, and uh-huh. girl saying that they can't read, they can't write.
Right. Right.
You know, and just the level of education that they got to. Usually right. grade 3, grade 8, maybe. Like the vast majority of my ancestors, you know, did not receive a K-12 education. Wow. And wow. to think that that's the world we want to return to. Somehow is just and then to say we want to recruit industry and we want to, you know, right. build our economy when there's no way we can fill those roles and provide that sort of skilled labor.
Yeah. As a public school teacher, I was always told that we were preparing kids for jobs that didn't exist yet. The idea of privatizing or making our public schools into a workforce preparation program that maybe works for some and not for others is really problematic, because we're going to prepare kids for today's economy, not tomorrow's economy, if we do things that way.
Sorry about that. So John, is it apocalyptic thinking on my part, or right. ultimate in cynicism?
Are you ready for it?
To think that there are a bunch of these folks who really and truly do want to destroy public education as we know it. And these sorts of steps that they're taking, you know, doing away with across the board raises, going to total merit pay, driving off more, you know, in the midst of a teacher crisis, driving away more teachers, cutting funding, you know, all these kind of not caring about class sizes, you know, wanting to micromanage what's taught in the classroom, all those sorts of things. Are all designed to hasten the actual demise of it and to turn the thing over entirely to either for-profit and or religious schools in this state.
Mm-hmm. Well, you ready for a dose of optimism?
Yes.
Here we go then. Rumors of the death of the public school system are greatly exaggerated. Let's go back to that number, 703,000 kids in our public schools. There's 20 public school students for every private school. The private schools in my district, in my city, have no intention of expanding to cover 20 times as many students. Homeschooling won't work for every parent. There aren't enough charter schools. Public schools exist because they are required by Oklahomans, and they deliver services to Oklahoma families every day. Meals, counseling, education, pathways forward, stability, safety, fulfillment, rigor, discipline. It all comes out of our public schools, and our public schools have been through a decade of budget cuts, came out of that stronger, went through the pandemic, came out of it stronger, went through the challenge of epic charter schools. And now most of our districts have virtual options that work better than epic charter schools, which is why so many kids are coming back from epic charter schools. They're going to keep coming up with schemes to dismantle our public school system, kind of like Wile E. Coyote going after the Roadrunner. And they're going to keep shooting themselves into the side of a mountain or go off the edge of the mesa because their half-brained schemes aren't going to work. And if you want to know what I mean about half-brained schemes, go back and review the footage about Tuesday's budget hearing. Meet me.
So I think all three of us would agree that, you know, we are looking for a system that embraces the notion of a rising tide raises all boats. Yep. And what I wonder is, the system that they want to create, if it in effect isn't a diminished tide that sinks all boats, because uh-huh. at the end of the day, not only do you risk creating a much wider chasm between the haves and the have-nots in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
But the haves are not going to get near the education that they're currently getting with the options that they currently have, with a lot of first-rate public schools or private schools if they want to go that route, or whichever direction they want to go.
Yeah. We should remember that our private schools they live symbiotically off the public schools, recruiting, teachers from them, often sharing resources, participating in athletic events and competitions with public schools. So if we blew up the public school system, if we convince Oklahomans that teachers are indoctrinators and turning their kids into furries, then where are the private schools going to get their teachers? What we'll see, I think, are more short-term embarrassments, like the rise and fall of Epic charter schools. We're going to see more disasters on the scale of the Gear Fund business, or maybe even on bigger scales. But then we're going to see the public school system reasserting itself and shaking off these phenomena like a bad cold, because the public needs a public school system that works for every kid. Private schools are not designed to take every kid or to offer the same standards of transparency and accountability. Charter schools are not designed to operate on the scale of the public school system. Not everybody can homeschool. If public schools did not exist, it would be necessary to invent them. And that's why we're going to win this round too.
Okay. I'm just replaying last session, you know, where Senator Treat brought his school choice bill to the floor, and you know, and he was defeated. He punished people for it, you know. So I mean, it really is kind of an interesting alliance when you think of, you know, Speaker McCall in the House being kind of, you know, the Rubicon in a sense.
Yeah.
That, you know, he's not hearing it when it comes to these, you know, these voucher bills. So because he is a rural legislator and he knows what it would mean for Atoka. And if our banker speaker can't get on board with this, you know, then.
Yeah, well, the people spent a lot of money trying to knock Chairman McBride out of his district and they lost. I do note that every educator on the Republican side of the Senate Education Committee was removed from that committee. There are the only educators on Senate Education now are Democrats. The House Common Education Committee got smaller, and as a result, I was forced to give up my seat on Common Education. I will note that another committee, State Powers, which is where we hear the bills about book banning and Biden's going to take your guns and all the all that just social.
That was the faith right committee 10 years ago. So yes. Yeah,
that committee got bigger. And that's a reflection of priorities by the Republicans. They're less interested in the issues that matter, like providing a quality education to every kid. And I do expect we're going to see more of this nonsense about vouchers, half-brain schemes, and we're going to hear more craziness in committees like State Powers. That's because
I kind of feel like the way it was with the States' Rights Committee back in the T.W. Yeah. Shannon days, that the State yeah. Power Committee is also an attempt to channel energy. Right. Yeah. Because you get through committee, but it doesn't necessarily mean that floor leader Eccles is going to hear it on the floor.
I know. Hopefully it's a place where bad bills go to die. I yes. just have the honor of being
like the rules committee, like the House rules used to be. Right. So, yes.
Yeah. I sure hope so, because some of the legislation I heard there was, you know, embarrassing.
Yes. For sure. I mean, it's what ends up on the Washington Post, you know, like, I mean, it's literally how we make the headlines these days, not because we've done anything good.
Yeah.
So John, how much of your optimism for the future of public education in Oklahoma is based on your belief, your confidence in your colleagues on the other side of the aisle who showed this week that they, you know, were not going to tolerate this kind of nonsense from the superintendent? I mean, when you have, you know, Del Krebs saying, I don't need elevator speeches, I need details. And you have McBride telling them, you know, get off the campaign rhetoric.
Yeah.
You know, you don't see Republicans act that way toward most other Republicans. You know, there's that old Ronald Reagan 11th commandment thing, right?
I also want to point out, like, there are committees where you can be, you know, kind of a piece of shit, excuse my language, but you know, the K-12 committee is not it, right? Like, people really take that committee seriously. The people that are on it, like, I mean, they have skin in that game. It's not your, you know, casual, just kind of blow through. I mean, you don't get these harebrained ideas. I mean, you do, but it's just like, people take that position seriously, you know, being on that committee. But really, when a state agency leader presents to the legislature that controls the purse strings, you expect something from that presentation. You really do. I mean,
yeah, that was an affront to us as a branch of government as a legislative body. And I appreciated my colleagues on the other side of the aisle for taking that stand. And the truth is, I depend on people like Chairman McBride to stop what's happened in the Senate from coming over to our side. But to come back to your question, Arnold, my faith is rooted in something deeper than that. 703,000 students in our public school systems, taught by tens of thousands of dedicated educators and support staff members who have survived fire and flood and pestilence and famine here in Oklahoma, and they're going to survive this one too. It's the people of Oklahoma who are going to save the public school system, because it's the people of Oklahoma who depend on it.
All right, so can we turn to the budget that he did present today?
Okay, yeah.
Brian Walters presented to this the newly reconstituted, highly not expertise State Board of Education with a regular cast of characters.
With the stipulation that I haven't finished my study of the budget.
I just have the high points as well. But let's talk about the fact that there was $300 million in Joy Hoffmeister's approved budget that were supposed to go straight towards across the board pay raises that has been cut in half. Right. $100 million of that is going instead to what sounds like the teacher merit pay stuff or whatever, some student fund. And then $59 million is going back to the state.
Well, I think that's unfortunate. In a time of an inflationary economy, when the teacher raises of 2018 have mostly been eaten up by events, in a time when the state is sitting on a record surplus of funds, at a time when we are thousands of dollars behind other states in the region in per pupil spending, the idea that we would give money back that could be invested in our kids, that's unconscionable. I sure hope that doesn't stand. This is a time to invest in our schools. We didn't do it last year. We haven't made a serious investment since 2019. It's time to make another one. And so, I don't accept that at all.
Let's see. I mean, that was like the big takeaway for me from today's hearing. it was quite a meaningful. A symbolic gesture, right? Right off the bat, send money back.
It's a slap in the face.
Then left in a position where, you know, it might have to say, here's what we're going to give you. And we're including in the law that you have to spend it this way. Because they do have this administration has a history, as we discussed earlier, of getting money and sitting on it and not using it for its intended purpose.
Right. Well, so, and specifically STITS appointees then doing budget requests similar to this, where they say, oh, well, we actually don't need that much money and we're going to give this money back. And the legislators sitting in the office are like, you're crazy. You do need, you know, this is not, we know this is not the budget you need, but this is the budget you're being told to give us. You know, that's a very real conversation that happens on the floor. I will say, okay, so back to, you're talking about his comments about reading, the science of reading. This is really like taking us back to the Wayback Machine, because he's referring to like the Reading Sufficiency Act and the Student Proficiency Act. So like, whoo, this is straight out of the Janet Parisi days, right?
Yeah, yes, it is.
Because I mean, my daughter was dyslexic, and so I was terrified for her to hit third grade and get held back because of that. Yeah. You know, and then things happened, and it worked out. But Let's see. I'm browsing a quick synopsis. So yeah, so the budget change summary. So Joy Hofmeister's administration submitted a budget request for teacher pay. Yeah. $309 million to go towards teacher pay across the board to raise this. So that would have been about a $5,000 across the board raise, which right. I can tell you that's a nice bump no matter what your salary is. Yeah. And then his current request, he bumped it down to $150 million. And then he's putting $100 million of that towards a student proficiency, some new line item, some new idea, some new
New vendors.
But exactly right. I mean, I think I've said this to you before, Representative Waldron, but I have a friend who started her teaching career actually as a Teach for America teacher, but it was in Camden, New Jersey schools.
And, that's a very difficult school district.
Yeah, Cory Booker, baby, right? So, like, I mean, very much like it was the trenches, but she goes, you know, and she learned this firsthand. She goes, there is profit in failure.
Yeah. Yes.
So when we talk about those education vendors, there you go.
If we designate a school as a failure, then we can qualify for all kinds of money that we can then spend on vendors who go back to those schools. Our A to F system, unfortunately, relies on testing and chronic absenteeism to identify those schools, which tend to be in poor and underprivileged neighborhoods with students facing lots of adverse childhood experiences. We then spend a lot of money on vendors who go in and train those teachers on how to do better jobs with the test scores. But until we address the root problems like adequacy of classroom sizes and availability of counselors, the mental health needs of the students, we find ourselves repeating the situation. And even if a school does show improvement, we reboot the system periodically and using a bell curve, take the bottom fifth of the schools and declare them all failures once all over again, which creates this optic where politicians can say, see, we're not doing, our public schools are all failures, and that's why we need to have privatization schemes. We can develop a system of measurement that it creates its own outcomes. And I think we're seeing that a lot with stuff like the Reading Sufficiency Act, with standardized testing and our A to F systems. It rewards the experts who come in to help tell us how not to be a failure, but I'm not sure that that money is well spent on actually improving outcomes for kids.
You know, so this makes me think of two things. First is those kids with chronic absenteeism. You know, I mean, one way, like, yes, it's absolutely detrimental, you know, to their overall health if they aren't in school every day. We actually got letters about this across the board at our elementary school today, where they were just kind of documenting, making parents aware of their child's absence record. But it just kind of shocked me. But then I just remember, like, in the state, chronic absenteeism, truancy, you know, is very much a concern. And I just think if they just remove some of those levers that require students to be there, it's not going to take much to get some kids falling straight through the cracks. Yeah. Right. Like, I mean, and I'm not saying I don't know how I feel about truancy court and parents being, you know, charged with things like that. But it's just, it occurs to me that with our, you know, social determinants of health being what they are in the state of Oklahoma, how easy it will be for kids who are already on the edge to fall through the cracks that much more quickly. Yeah. Wow. I mean, it's just, it's very tenuous at best, right? For some of these families. Yeah. Oh gosh. And my second point, I've totally lost, it'll come back to me. It'll come back. Okay.
Well, when it comes to something, a measure like chronic absenteeism, it does correlate with things like the lack of success in school overall. And you can draw a line between chronic absenteeism and, for example, incarceration, which is what I think motivated politicians to pass the Reading Sufficiency Act in the first place and to create the A to F system. The trouble is that our current A to F is punitive. It mostly punishes schools, and it punishes schools for something they might not control. Why is the kid chronically absent? Maybe the 14-year-old has to take care of a 9-year-old or a sick grandmother at home. Maybe there's a lack of transportation. Maybe they don't have clean clothes. Lots of schools have experimented with adding laundry machines to the schools, and they found that attendance suddenly improved enormously. If we had a positive approach to problems like absenteeism, we might get better results. Instead, we label the school a failure and we bring in outside experts. I actually have a bill that would replace that with a qualitative measure that gave schools a chance to identify their own solutions.
And actually, I remember you remind me of what my second point was. Yes, you did it. Thank you. I actually, you know, if we think of the ways that, and I'm sorry, I want to be optimistic like you about public schools. And it's not that I'm not, and I don't think they're resilient and that we don't have fabulous educators around the state. But it just made me think of Naomi Klein's shock doctrine and what happened in New Orleans public school after Katrina, right? Public school system down there, the public school systems in like some of our most impoverished, you know, cities and metro areas around the country, where they effectively privatize it by turning every public school into a charter. And so, you know, just the ways that I don't put it past single one, like, you know, the way that they are undermining one confidence in our public schools by calling them all these things. I'm sorry, but Representative Waldron, don't you just wish your students would have like read your syllabi, much less like this is how I feel about my college. I wish I could at least get them to do that, like to think that I had indoctrinated them to anything would have been just like, you know, the high point of my teaching.
I know, maybe but, I could have gotten them to put their phones down.
I know, right? Like, I mean, just turn your stuff in on time. But somehow we're like pushing porn and that's successful. But it just absolutely blows my mind. Like, clearly you haven't been in a classroom lately. So anyways, but just this, there's so many times on here, just like throwing the baby with the bathwater, you know, like, or making it so small you can drown it in the bathtub. Like all of these.
Here's another one that we tend to do. We tend to take discrete problems and address them systemically. So why is the kid absent? The kid is absent because he's got a sick grandmother and he doesn't have, you know, clean clothes. So the solution is help get that family access to services and put in a washing machine. Instead, we apply a systemic solution, which downgrades the school's rating and encourages politicians to say, see, these schools are failures.
And it's interesting then that Ryan's whole line, excuse me, Superintendent Walter's whole line is, we treat students, not systems.
Well, we're going to treat
individuals. Which is not what he's doing at all.
Right. With a systemic purge, it seems. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to purge dollars out of the system. We're going to purge teachers out of the system. Mm-hmm. And we're going to purge public confidence out of the system.
Without thinking of implications or consequences.
He is the king of projection. I mean, this is the guy, you know, we're going to end indoctrination in schools. And he's the first guy who wants to march all the teachers into a lecture hall with the Hillsdale College curriculum, right?
Yeah, it's Orwellian. And what I find is that a lot depends on who's talking and who you're talking to. Knocking doors for school board candidates, I found lots and lots of parents who supported their public schools and love their kids' teachers, who are important influences in their kids' lives every day. But I also heard a lot of people who were older or maybe didn't have kids in the system, and instead were getting these messages about indoctrination. Now, it's true that our society is changing and the younger generation is very different from the ones that came before, as it should be expected. But it's not the public schools that are causing social change. Public schools are experiencing and dealing with the effects of social change. And to blame them for things that are happening or things that politicians are telling you that are happening that actually are not happening. There are no litter boxes in our school, let me say that categorically. But to scare people and villainize the public schools is really it's a pretty deceitful way to achieve an end, which is to take a lot of money out of the public school system and reward private profit seekers who maybe are going to make big fat contributions to your campaign chest.
And it's just that simple.
It's just that simple. Follow the money. Let me tell you, folks, if the money stays in the public schools, we have the Oklahoma Cost Accounting Standards system. Every purchase is itemized and available for scrutiny. We gave something like $230 million to the public schools in the CARES Act, and another $130 went to the private schools, which are only 5% of the size of the public schools. The private schools did not know how to use the federal dollars and found that they had to file their request through the State Department. They had to use public services to order things. Sometimes they would submit requests for individual books without their ISBN numbers, because private schools were not set up to spend all that money. And that's the only way we got to know how that money was spent. Normally, private schools keep their budgets, their admissions practices, their hiring practices, a much more discreet matter. That's not cool if we're talking about taxpayer dollars. So remember, every dollar that goes to the public school system is accountable. If we put it in the private school systems or in the hands of management organizations like Epic Youth Services, that may be a big black box. And next thing you know, there's a big market for secondhand plasma screen TVs because people have just bought them with public dollars.
Yep. Well, you know, kind of looking forward to this session. It, you know, kicks off in 2 weeks. Is that right?
Yeah, a week from Monday, I think, the first day in February.
Yeah, and so, you know, bills are filed. We hope to have kind of a recap of the high points, or I don't know, low points of session, you know, coming soon. But Arnold, do you have any closing thoughts? Or
no, I'm just, John, I'm glad.
I see you ruminating, so I'm just wondering.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, we could talk for hours probably on all this stuff, and I appreciate your optimism because, you know, I have, you know, my kids are grown, but I have five grandkids in public schools here in Oklahoma. And I've said many times, I want them to get a good quality education, which I think they're getting. I'm very pleased with what I see. But I want them to be able to live in a state that is prosperous, and they can stay here if they want to. If they need to go somewhere else to scratch the itch, that's okay too. But it all starts with public ed, in my view.
And that's correct.
I appreciate your optimism because it makes me feel a whole lot better that while it feels like we can go a whole lot lower, maybe not.
Yeah.
Maybe this will be the Walters and Stitt administrations will be the, you know, the floor.
The nadir, however you say it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm about to run out of battery here, but I'll close by saying that I am very interested to see how the proponents of school choice are going to find places for 703,000 desks in charter schools and private schools and maybe church basements around Oklahoma. I don't think they can do it, at least based on what I've seen right now. Based on their ability to do homework, I'm going to give them a D-.
That's a great point. Yep. Thank you so much for your time tonight, Representative Waldron. This was an important conversation, and we hope we can revisit it sometime with you in the future.
Thank you. I love being on the Observer Cast, and I always appreciate the work you guys are doing.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Godspeed.
Thank you.
You're all right. Talk to you soon.
Remember, remember the slogan of the legislature. What's the worst that can happen?
Yeah. Have a good night, sir.
Yeah, you too. Take care.
If you like what you hear on ObserverCast, please tell your friends about us. Also, if you're interested in sponsoring ObserverCast, give Arnold Hamilton a call at 405-478-8700 or drop him an email at ahamilton@okobserver.org.
You also can support ObserverCast with a tax-deductible donation to the Oklahoma Observer Democracy Foundation, whose mission is to help create a better, more informed Oklahoma. To help keep us on the air, visit okobserver.org and click on the Donate button on the upper right side of the homepage. We also urge you to subscribe to the Oklahoma Observer, now in our 53rd year of comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. We have a special digital subscription rate for ObserverCast listeners, only $1.99 a month for the first year. That's 50% off the usual rate for monthly digital subscribers. Just use the coupon code ObserverCast when checking out to get the discount rate.
Finally, we want to thank Norman's Jared Deck for the music you're listening to today. You can download his albums at iTunes and learn more at jareddeckmusic.com.